Israel. That's a subject everybody's thinking about today. I was surprised by what happened. I usually am surprised by what happens in Israel. But the question is, how do we bring this into focus for some perspective? What's happening? Now, maybe we can't always identify something that's happening right now scripturally, because there's a lot of things that happen. But this one was unusual. Is there any way to see how this fits in perspective? Well, maybe. We're going to look at some, first of all, the borders of Israel. We're going to look at what it is that Israel is perhaps going to be acquiring. Now, this comes to my mind because right now, Gaza and the West Bank are two places in Israel that are of particular interest and focus. And I think those are parts of the promised land. So that's why we're going to talk about the land of promise and just where it was, where it should go, where it was designated to be. Then we're going to look and see historically something about the reestablishment of Israel in 1948 and the issues that have taken place since that time. Now we have here a map just taken from the internet about Israel. And these are all the 12 tribes of Israel. Now you'll see that over here we have on the east bank of the River Jordan, we have some areas that were obtained by Reuben and Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh. Now today it doesn't look like Israel's got that or any prospect to get that. So how do we reconcile that with what's happening today? Well, one way is to say, well, in the future they will get that. However, I would like to notice that these were not lands that God originally planned for Israel. I'm going to put another, see, this is, I don't seem to be functioning. So I'll wait until that does. But you will notice that if you go to the book of Deuteronomy and you see where, and the book of Numbers, excuse me, the book of Numbers where Moses comes to the land of promise. Now, I wish I could walk and talk. Maybe I'll try to do that. Is that okay? Try to do that. Let's see. See if this continues for me. Moses came up with the Israelites down from this area. And they came up in the area of Edom. And Edom, of course, is called Edom. Thank you so much. And Moses came down into the land of Edom. It's not on this map. But Moses, of course, recognized that Edom is really from Esau. That's really relatives of Israel. That was the brother of Jacob. And so Moses knew that land was not going to be his. So he wrote to Edom and he said, I'd like to come through your land. I mean you no harm. We're just going to pass through. And Edom said, the king of Edom said, no, you won't pass through. We won't permit it. So Moses had to detour a little bit to the right and he continued. And then he came up to the other and he found out that the area of Moab and Ammon. Now Moab and Ammon are really descendants from Lot. That also is a relative of the Abrahamic family. So that's not part of the land of promise. And therefore God says you won't get that land either. However, at that time, these portions of Moab and Ammon had already been taken by the Amorites, by another group of people. And he told Sihon and Og, the king of the Amorites, we're not going to mean to do you any harm. We just want to come through the land and we're going to cross over the Jordan and take the other land. And they said, no, we won't allow you to do that. And therefore they came out with an armed conflict. God gave them the victory, gave Israel the victory over Gog, Sihon, and Og, and therefore God says, now you can take that land because they have militarily confronted you. But if you look in Ezekiel, the 48th chapter, and you find the definition of the land in the kingdom, I won't say that proves the point, but it does support the thought that maybe Israel will not get that land there either. Because in Ezekiel 48, if you look at the directions of the division of the land there, none of this land is part of Israel. Now, it's part of Jordan today. I suspect that's the way it's going to remain. Right now, Israel and Jordan have a peace. We'll talk about peace in just a moment. And So it looks to me like maybe the land of Canaan does not include that area. Now let's see. This is not working still. So I'm not unable to advance. So maybe I'll ask you to advance slides physically. It was still working. When you can, please do so. Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. Now, this is showing on this black and white map where Dan originally had his allotment of land when Joshua gave them a division of the land. But Dan later moved way up to the north. And you see way up in the north, that's where Dan is. Now, oh, I'm sorry. That was the wrong button. Okay. Okay. Now I'm going to go down to the south. And you'll find in Genesis, the 15th chapter, verse 18, that God promised Abraham that the land of promise will go from the river of Egypt up to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, there has been some question, what is the river of Egypt? Could it possibly be the Nile River? Not really. That's not what God meant. If that was the case, before they left Egypt, they'd already be in the land of promise. But the Wadi El Arish is what is called the river of Egypt. And that wadi is this red area that you see on the map. And that exits and goes out into the Mediterranean Sea at a place called El Arish. Now, that's not a continual river. Just when that mountainous area in the middle has rain, it will drift down there, and it will go out to the Wadi El Arish. So you can see that Israel already has land that takes you to the border of that Wadi El Arish. And the other reason we know that's it's the Wadi and not the Nile River is because it contrasts the great river, the River Euphrates in the north. Well, the River Euphrates isn't bigger than the Nile, so it is bigger than the Wadi El Arish. Okay, now you'll see a scripture also in 1 Chronicles, the 18th chapter, verse 3, that talks about the far north borders of the land. Now, I don't have on this map a way of showing the Euphrates. It's quite up farther north. But you'll see that in the land that Israel has today, they do have the Golan Heights here. That's kind of an orange area. They don't have this red area. They don't have this West Bank. This is what Israel has today. This East Bank. But farther up north, you're going to find the Euphrates River. Now, in 1 Chronicles 18:3, David smote Hadad-Ezer, king of Joba, unto Hamath as he went to establish his kingdom by the river Euphrates. And God did promise the land that far. Israel doesn't have anything close to that today. Will they ever get that land? Well, I have a suggestion that if they do, if that is intended, that probably will wait until the kingdom. That's my opinion. Well, let's go a little farther and let's see some other areas. So at this point, what is it that Israel has yet to have restored to them that we might expect before the kingdom? Well, that would be Gaza and this area known here on this drawing as the West Bank of the River Jordan. Now, can I go back to this either way? Okay. Today, we're involved in a Gaza problem. Now, is Gaza really part of the promised land? Yes, definitively it is. You can see that in Joshua, the 13th chapter, in the first three verses. That's where God says to Joshua, you're getting old, Joshua, and there's much more land to be received. And in verse 3, he mentions by name, Gaza, the Gazathites. And so we know that that is a part of the land that was intended by God to be received. Now, I might have said, a few days ago, a month ago, I don't know when they might receive that back. I don't know. But it looks to me like now Israel's going to receive it back because right now they're involved in securing it again. But Israel doesn't really want it back. All they want is for the enemy to desist from striking out. So I don't think it's going to happen right away. I think it's going to be a process. And we'll talk about that in a few more minutes. What about the West Bank? Now, there have been suggestions by brethren that have come my way that say that maybe Israel is going to annex the West Bank. just as they did annex the Golan Heights a few years ago. Well, maybe, maybe not. But it looks to me like we're now in the beginning of a process that will lead to that. Now, we're going to go a little bit farther. And there is the Euphrates way up north, and that's where King David finally pushed the extent of his government. Okay. Now, we have here in 1978 the first beginning of a series of peace processes between Israel and their Arab neighbors. Now, I think that this took a considerable period of years. It started in 1978 with the Camp David Accords, but it didn't really take root for some years after that. In fact, it was 1979, after this jovial picture was taken, that really there was a peace accord signed between Egypt and Israel. And it was, what, 15 or 16 years later that Jordan signed a peace agreement. Now, to my surprise, in the last year that President Trump was president, there were the Abraham Accords. That surprised me. It kind of came out of nowhere as far as I was concerned. But I kind of think that that brought into harmony with Israel. Maybe harmony is not the right word. Into a cessation of hostilities with Israel. A number of governments. Now, you'll find all of these listed here as governments of the Arab countries that have made peace, or at least have by inference made peace with Israel. There's Egypt, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, Malawi. And Malawi is not an Arab country, but Malawi even made, you know, sent an ambassador to Israel and wanted to be on good terms with them. Now, we're going to go back in time a little bit. We're going to look at when Israel actually became a nation. Now, you know when that was. You know that it was in 1948. Most of us were not living at that time, but it's very well-known history. I think 1948 is a meaningful year. Now, I don't think anybody ahead of 1948 projected this has got to be the year. But we're looking retrospectively. Is 1948 a year of meaning, or is it just a random year that would have happened? Now, in 1948, that's when Israel became a nation. That was the end of a process that started way back with the first Jewish colony. Now, I think most of you remember what the name of that Jewish colony was, Petah Tikva. I think you could all say it in your memory. That was 1878. How many years were there from 1878 to 1948? 70 years. That's a nice round number. But it reminds me that Israel lost their national independence when Babylon had authority for, that was 70 years. So is this coincidence that Israel regained their national sovereignty in a period of 70 years? I don't think so. I think it's a meaningful number. It's engaged my attention for a while. Well, let's see. Let's try something else. In your mind's eye, let's take you back to the time of the flood of Noah's day. You know that in the book of Peter, 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter, Peter says that the ark represents our redemption in Christ. If you're in the ark, you're saved. If you're in the ark, you are trusting in Christ in what he has done for us, for our salvation. When do you get into the ark? Well, you get into the ark when Jesus has died and made it available. And now that wooden ark, I think, represents the wooden cross that gave us redemption. You go 40 days of rain. Do those 40 days of rain have any meaning on a day-for-a-year basis? Let's try it. Go from 33 A.D., 40 years ahead, you get to 73 A.D. That was the end of the 7 years of the Roman revolt, with the fall of Masada. So maybe those 40 days of rain are the first 40 years of trouble after Jesus' death. But you go 5 months, much broader than could be, a day for a year period. 5 months that before the ark finally comes to ground and lands. What do those 5 months represent? Well, we're at the beginning of the gospel age when Jesus died. When you enter into the holy at the beginning of the gospel age, what do you see? Five pillars. Five is a symbol of the new creation. Could those 5 months be the period in which the new creation is developed until the end of the age and the harvest? Well, I think so. Now, let's suppose, therefore, that those 5 months take you to the harvest at the end of the age. Now, you go back to the tabernacle. Once you're through the holy, what do you get to? The most holy. And when do saints begin going beyond the veil? Well, not until after Christ returns, and then the dead in Christ are raised first, and afterwards, one by one, we're gathered beyond. So let's suppose for a moment that maybe those 5 months take you to the beginning of the Lord's return in 1874. Now you can count in Genesis chapter 8 unambiguously, and they would be 74 days later that what they saw out in the distance was the first ocular hope, visible sign that things are going to be better. 74 days later, they saw the top of the mountains out in the distance. The top of the mountains. Boy, that reminds me of Micah chapter 4. The mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains. Now, we're not there yet. We're not to the kingdom inaugurated at Israel yet. We're not there. We all know that. But is it possible that what we saw in 1948, the beginning of that mountain, that kingdom, the beginning of Israel's independence, is the first sign, tangibly, visibly, that we see of the approaching kingdom? Now, we use all kinds of signs of the times. I realize that. We have the time of trouble. We have the gathering of the saints. But this one, the establishment of Israel, nobody can miss. That everybody can see. So the top of the mountains was the first sign that the problems of the flood are ending and things are going to get better. I think that was the sign in 1948. Now you go farther from that, and finally you get to the time where they see the floodwaters all dried. That would be the kingdom. That would be the curse entirely removed. But all they see 74 days after the end of the 5 months is the beginning sign of out there that the kingdom indeed is coming. We have another one. This one isn't as well known. This is in Daniel, the 7th chapter. Now, I think all of you know that in Daniel chapter 7, you find a picture of the four world governments that are going to dominate Israel for more than 2,000 years. That's where Daniel has his vision of the lion and the bear and the leopard and the leopard with four heads, and then the great dreadful beast that represents Rome. These four world governments are going to dominate Israel for more than 2,000 years. Well, turns out that if you look at the date of that vision, that date was 553 BC. It's the first year of Belshazzar. Now, just so you know, that date is not very well known by the brethren. But there's no reason that any brethren would object to that date. Just want you to know. Sometimes they will object to my dates. Not on this case. Nobody will object to 553. Nobody hardly knows it, but there would be no objection. 553. 2,500 years later, exactly, Israel is a nation again. Okay, it catches my attention. Okay, Ezekiel 40, verse 1. That begins 8 or 9 chapters of the vision of the millennial kingdom. That very date, 2,520 years later, will take you to 1948. So I think that this is not random. That's the whole point here. I think it's not random. Now, the question is, what about that date, 1978? Never occurred to me that that might be a meaningful date as well. But it might be. Now, if that is a meaningful date, that means that this is the date when the Arab nations begin to come in accord with Israel, at least so they're no longer attacking them. And that's where we are today. We're at a time after the Abraham Accords where there is no, I'm going to say, Arab nation that is ready to defeat and in battle against Israel. Now you say, wait a minute, what about Iran? Their inveterate foe. Iran is not Arab. Iran is Persia. Persia was Japheth. They're not Semite. Now, those of you who look carefully at Ezekiel 38 and the final conflict against Israel, you know that there is not a single Semitic nation involved in, listed at least in Ezekiel 38. Not a single one. I think this from 1978 forward has engaged a process of peace that has taken us to the point where there is no Arab nation that is publicly ready to attack Israel. Now, earlier today, we heard a reference. Which talk was that? Was it Brother Jay's talk? To Jacob coming back to the land after being gone for 20 years. And he knows he's going to meet his brother Esau. Not looking forward to that. I think there's a picture there of Israel coming back to their land after the gospel age of the Spirit, represented by the 20 years. And they know they're going to have a problem. So what did Jacob do? He sent his men with herds of animals as gifts to Esau to prepare the way and tenderize his heart. I kind of think that's what Israel has been doing, figuratively, for a long time. They've been helping the Arabs, giving them this benefit and that and the other. Even the Jordan Valley wouldn't be what it is for Jordan today without Israel's help, assistance, and encouragement. So I think that gradually is tenderizing the hearts of the Arab nations. They don't really love Israel, but then Esau didn't really love Jacob yet. It wasn't until the sun rose the next morning that Jacob and Esau met and embraced and wept for each other. That hasn't happened yet. That's not going to happen until the sun, the dawn of the new day, is really here. That won't happen until, in my opinion, Abraham is back. And then there's a reason for all of those who respect Abraham to recognize that they should be at peace and loving one another. So this is the beginning of the process for the Arab nations to come into accord. Now, many of you are familiar with the fact that in Psalms 83, there is a psalm about how the Arab nations are inveterate foes of Israel. They want to drive them into the sea. Now, that has been the case from 1948 when five Arab nations attacked Israel. And in 1967 when Egypt and Assyria and some other nations attacked Israel again, and Israel was surprised and they had to defend off this problem. Actually, what happened was Israel recognized it was imminent and Israel went on the offensive. And then in 1973 when Egypt and Syria attacked Israel from two ends. That was a surprise. Israel almost didn't survive that. We'll see that in just a moment. And when we go to the book of Zechariah. So all of that, I think, has been winding down. So even Saudi Arabia, that's a major factor in the area, is not listed here in this list. But Saudi Arabia really is, in theory, at peace with Israel. They don't want to attack Israel. If it wasn't for Saudi Arabia's agreement, half of these nations would not have agreed because they're dependent on Saudi Arabia. Why is Saudi Arabia making peace with Israel today? Why are they not hostile to Israel? Let me express it that way. There's a very good reason. Right across the stream from Saudi Arabia is Iran. Iran, as you may know, is Shiite. Saudi Arabia is Sunni. It's like two things, water and oil, just don't mix. They just have a problem. Now, what's happening today with Gaza? Gaza is Sunni, but they are sponsored by Iran as long as Hamas is going to fight and destroy Israel. Opinion here? I don't think Iran cares too much whether Hamas loses or not. They've done their job. They're Sunni. They're not that well attached. Up in the north in Lebanon, you have Hezbollah. Hezbollah is Shiite, not Sunni. I don't think Iran wants Hezbollah to lose. I don't think that Hezbollah is going to take all their forces and march into Israel because that would cause them to lose. Now, next week, after I get home, maybe you'll see that was wrong. We'll see. I'm giving you a suggestion. But if we don't see Hezbollah formally, officially attack, now they're sending missiles over all the time. I realize that. But if I don't think they're going to actually invade in a difficult way, because I think Iran would be afraid of losing Hezbollah. Well, we'll see. Okay, now we're going to go a little farther than this. And here's where Israel is today. There's Gaza, and there's the West Bank. And I have a suggestion that perhaps the activity that we have seen start this year in 2023 may be the beginning again of a process, not immediate, but a process for Israel to receive back those which are indisputably part of the land of promise. Now, we already saw, we didn't read it, but we referred you to it, Joshua 13, 1, 2, and 3, where Gaza is listed expressly by God to Joshua as part of the as yet unconquered land. Well, I find it interesting that one of the last parts of what is clearly part of Israel is only today coming at blows, as it were. Now, you see the West Bank. Nobody disputes that believes in the Bible that the West Bank is really part of Israel. That was part of Judea and Samaria. That's intrinsically part of Israel. And in the kingdom, it will be as well. So I think right now what we're seeing is the beginning, only the beginning, of a lengthy process that might restore those back to Israel. Go forward here a little bit. Now, earlier I mentioned 1948 as a date of interest in the scriptures. And I think that there is one more reference to 1948 that caught my attention. I've known about this for a few years. We've talked about it now and then, haven't given it much publicity. But here's the normal 1260 years that we all talk about from the book of Daniel, and that is, of course, the right application for the 1260. That is probably, not probably, it is the most well-known time prophecy of the entire scripture. It's twice in the book of Daniel. It's repeated five times in the book of Revelation. It starts with the time for spiritual Israel, when an influence over spiritual Israel, with papacy taking over in 539, ascended to the leadership of the Christian world. And then 1260 years later, finally there was an intervention and that was broken. Well, now, when you start with natural Israel, is it possible that there is a parallel? And it's only a parallel, and it's not in Revelation. It would only be a parallel to natural Israel. If you look at 688, what you find is that's when the Dome of the Rock was constructed. It wasn't finished there. It began there. 688, the golden dome that you normally see when you look at a vision, a picture of Jerusalem, that began in 688. Well, it caught my attention that 1260 years later would take you to 1948. Now, I've known that, like I said, for some years. But, you know, I wasn't sure it was meaningful, but it looked meaningful. So we suggested to the brethren it might have some interest. But now look what happens when we expand this a little bit. It turns out that with the 1290 days taking you 30 years beyond that, if you take it to natural Israel, that would be 1978. And if you take 1335 days to 1874, that would be another 45 years to 2023. Now, I have known of this option for some time. Other brethren have told me about it. I was skeptical. I wasn't sure. They said, you know, I expect something to happen in 2023. And I said, maybe. But I was a little skeptical. But suddenly something happened a month ago, and it caught my attention. Now, if you were like me, if you heard some brethren talking about this for a year, year and a half, and then something happened, well, you'd pay attention to it. So I think that this might be meaningful. Am I sure? No, I'm not. We'll see. We'll see how time goes by. But it looks engaging to me that this, which is so prominent for spiritual Israel, might have a parallel to natural Israel. And if it does, that would at least explain that we have three steps in the process of leading to the kingdom. Number one, to restore the national identity of Israel. That's like the top of the mountain seen out in the distance. That's the restoration of Israel after 70 years. Number two, the beginning of the process of peace with the Arab nations that takes decades to accomplish. Now, when those Abraham Accords came out in last year of President Trump. I was surprised. Oh, I didn't expect that. What did I expect? I don't know. I didn't really know what to expect. But at that time, I thought, well, that's interesting. And it does show that before the last battle comes, the Arab nations would be pretty much at least not militarily hostile to Israel. So maybe that's the beginning of that process in 1978. And then in 2023, is this the beginning of the process whereby the last indisputably Israeli land finally comes into their control? Now, right now, I don't think the nation of Israel even wants those lands back, not fully. But I think they're going to be encroaching farther and farther into that area. And spiritually, I think it does belong to them. Okay. We're back here now. And what we want to do is go to two of the prophets. Time is so short. But we're going to go to the book of Micah. We're going to look at a long-range perspective on the recovery of Israel in the book of Micah. Now, this is Micah chapter 5. And this starts way long time ago when Israel lost their national existence way back under Babylon. This is Micah 5. We're going to read verse 1. Now gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. Now when does that apply and who does that apply to? Now for many years I thought that was referring to Jesus. And we studied the book of Micah in our home class years ago. And I looked for any record I could find that they smote Jesus with a rod, and I couldn't find anything that said they smote him on the cheek. And then I realized that more and more that this really, and other commentaries suggested the same, this really is about Zedekiah. Zedekiah lost his throne way back at the under Babylon when Babylon invaded under Nebuchadnezzar. But now in verse 2, so who's going to be the next king? Well, but thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, out of thee shall come he that shall be ruler in Israel. Well, that's Jesus. That's unambiguous. Verse 3, therefore will he give them up, because they rejected their Messiah, until the time that she that travails has brought forth. When does she that travails bring forth? Well, if you go back to chapter 4 of Micah, verse 10, you'll see it says that Israel travailed when they were in Babylon, and they delivered by their return from Babylon and their reestablishment. Now, that happened literally way back, but spiritually, that happens today. Israel has gone through the Babylonian captivity of Christendom for all these years. They're back now. They have travailed in birth, and they have given birth to a nation again. Now, verse 5, the final intervention by God. This shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, when he shall tread in our palaces. Then we will raise against him 7 kings and 8 princes. Who would that be but the intervention of the church and the ancient worthies on behalf of Israel? And notice what it says in verse 6. They, that is the kings and the princes, shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword and deliver Israel. But what is Jacob's own response in this last final battle? Verse 7. The remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as showers from the grass, that tarries not for man and waits not for the sons of men. In other words, in this large panoramic vision of the punishment of Israel and their deliverance, the very last judgment that comes against the enemies of Israel is not fought by Israel directly. This is done by God. This is done from beyond the veil. I don't even think the ancient worthies are going to pick up arms. They're ready to introduce a kingdom of peace, and this is going to be, from Israel's point of view, non-combatant. Now, our time is getting too short. Can you go back? I don't think that'll work. So we're going to just have to summarize and explain what we might have said in more detail. If you look in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verses 10 through 23, you'll find this is a time when Israel was beset by three enemies. I could make a picture of those three enemies, but we don't have time for that. But Jahaziel came before Jehoshaphat and said, in response to your prayer before God, you will not even need to fight in this battle. God's going to take care of you. You won't have to fight. And so Jehoshaphat went out with singers, not an army. And as they observed, the three parties against them began battling against themselves and killed themselves off. I think that's consistent with Micah's testimony. One more. That is Hezekiah. You'll find this in Isaiah, the 37th chapter, 33 through 26. When they were beset upon by a Sennacherib, king of Assyria, God says, no, I'm going to defend this city so much that they shall not even shoot an arrow into the city. And again, Israel did not need to fight in that battle. But now let's quickly, if we may, turn to the book of Zechariah and see what Zechariah says about the last experiences leading to Israel's deliverance. Now, this is Zechariah chapter 12, and we're just going to tell you a few verses. Verses 1 through 4 are all about Jerusalem being a burdensome stone to the Gentiles. I'm going to suggest that those verses apply to 1948 until finally 1967. And then in verse 6, and that day will I make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited in her own place. That happened in 1967, and it was a remarkable military accomplishment. But then something else happened that required the Lord's intervention. Verse 8, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. That happened in 1973. That's when Israel almost lost that war and their nation. And then in verse 9, finally, the fourth battle, the fourth possibility of Israel being destroyed. It shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. I think that's at the introduction to the kingdom, Ezekiel 38. And then I will pour out the Spirit upon the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and of supplications. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced. And there, I think we're going to have to close. So much more to say. Ezekiel 38 is the last battle. No Arab nations against them. All un-Arab, hateful nations that God will intervene to spare Israel and introduce the kingdom. So where are we today? Maybe. We'll see. Maybe at the beginning of the third phase of operations. 1948 national restoration and defeating the Arabs nation by nation. 1978, maybe the beginning of the peace process, not really all that peaceful, but at least it's non-combative. And maybe 2023, maybe the beginning of Israel acquiring the last remnants of what is indisputably their own territory before the kingdom. We'll watch and we'll wait and then we'll see. Lord bless you. Thank you.